1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 151, Death and Dying, Changing LDS Ethics, by Lou W. Wallace.
Dr. Lou W. Wallace, MD, and this is the first time I've met Dr. Wallace, just right now, actually. Sunstone asked me to introduce him, and my first time at Sunstone was last year, and I did hear your wife speak last year. I enjoyed her talk very much. Dr. Wallace is apparently lives in the summer in Idaho and in the winter in San Gabriel, California. He's an MD, retired from Act 70, has been a 70 since 1939 by choice. Not sure what that means, but some probably do. Area of interest, medicine, a BS in pharmacy. And from ISU, AME, a School of Aviation Medicine, and an MD degree from USC, School of Medicine, and a hobby residential design and construction and woodworking. Is that right? I like woodworking, too. mission in East Germany, 1939. Finished in Western United States. Married Nola Woodland, Salt Lake Temple, March 1945. There's four children, two girls, two boys, and four grandchildren, two girls and two boys also. Lifelong interest in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, over 100 books in his personal library. And Sunstone, he's had two Sunstone West papers, The Master Psychiatrist and The Garden in Eden, two responses to papers. His grandfather, as a note of interest, built the first LDS chapel in Kentucky in 1896. And maternal ancestors settled outside the area of Ammon, now outside of Eagle Rock, now in now Idaho Falls. So we will turn the time over to Dr. Wallace, and he'll proceed. And afterwards, if we have any questions, we'll take questions.
I'm not really a scholar. Scholars, you know, they find bits of information and they catalog them and who wrote it and what where it was published and so forth. I'm a reader. I read everything I can get my hands on, stuff it into my own computer, and if it, since things change in medicine so rapidly, I don't even bother to record the person's name, really. Most of this, as you can tell as I go along, has come from many sources, and the immediate precipitating cause of the paper was twofold. One, the doctor in San Gabriel had a seminar on dying, and he had an internist, a lawyer, and a minister there. And strangely enough, 90% of the questions from the audience were directed to the lawyer, not the minister, not the doctor. And then at the education meeting on organ transplants, the difficulties that come up in brain death and having to wait for the brain to be completely dead before you can claim organs. I will be getting into that. But those two things kind of coalesced and made me wonder about changing LDS ethics, not only past, but present and perhaps future changes that will be forced upon us. Dealing with death, the subject of death and dying, is difficult, for death is often accompanied by pain and suffering and grief. We avoid it. We even dodge the word death when possible. Dr. Fulgham lists 30 euphemisms that we use instead. Most of us are like Woody Allen. We have nothing against death. We just don't want to be there when it happens. Any meaningful dialogue about death requires the establishing of acceptable definitions. These are, as yet, so theoretical and controversial that agreement seems impossible. This is compounded by our lack of definitive knowledge, our relative ignorance, if you put it bluntly, about such things, and is further complicated by our ecclesiastical theories, doctrines, dogmas, customs, and folklore. We need to develop an ethos about death which is based on laws of common sense, reason, and logic, as well as on revelation. The concepts developed over 4,000 years of Jewish Christian history were incorporated into Mormon theology through the King James Bible, which we've unfortunately, I think, canonized despite the prophet's lack of compunction about rewriting it. Problems regarding life and death have become much more acute as our knowledge of and control over these things has increased. For example, just what is death? When is death? And when is something dead? We're faced with a circular definition. You know, you look it up, death is the absence of life. What's life? Well, that's the absence of death. I decided to approach the subject by first trying to define life, since death is, quote, not an experience within recoverable memory, unquote, as one psychiatrist put it. The meanings of life extend from basic biology and physiology to the most complex of human social situations. Human life is not really simply a brief segment of an immortal continuum marked with a beginning when you breathe the air of this earth and an end when you stop breathing. Theologians, lawyers all try to group, mark, and certify, but there's no resolution of the definition problem, nor has there ever been one, as near as I can tell. Start with the question, what is life? Actually, what is alive? This is not as easy to answer as it might seem. The white crystals in the vial on the laboratory shelf, are they alive? The material looks inactive, inert, and apparently innocuous. They're viroids, tiny pieces of RNA with probably less than 10,000 atoms. Viruses are larger and have a protein coat. However, on a tobacco plant, this viroid enters the plant's cells and forces them to replicate itself. Is it alive? Perhaps so, since viruses can be inactivated. Do we kill them or by heat or chemicals? And this fulfills one definition of life, that life is the absence of death. Or is this viroid both or neither dead nor alive, really? Is it halfway between? Are you fully alive when you sleep? What about plants and animals with hibernation or dormancy? A dormouse in hibernation is cold and stiff and appears dead. Tetanus and other bacteria can go into a spore stage and remain inert in the soil for decades. How close to death, quote unquote, is that? In humans, is death the cessation of breathing? Or is it the stopping of the heart? Or is it the absence of all brain electrical activity, as certified by two specifically designated uninvolved clinicians? This is our three pages of what it takes to be one of those doctors to certify brain death. Or is it the cessation of all usual biological activity when rigor mortis sets in? Actually, of course, I'm dealing with physiological death here. There's social death. Some people, some religions, a person violates their religion, they're cut off from the people and their family, they're just, you're dead, period, as far as the other people are concerned. And, of course, I will mention the living dead later on. When we try to pin down a universal definition of human life, the problem is almost hopelessly complex, even on a simple biological level, due mainly to the religious concepts of spirit and soul. All who see a human before death and again after death are struck with the reality that the essence of the person is gone, departed. That life, quote-unquote, or existence, continues after mortal death has been believed in or hoped for by all known peoples, to judge from their burial customs. the 30,000-year-old grave in the cave floor in France, where the weapons, food, and implements needed in an afterlife were with the body, as were some flowers. That is a good example. Immortality itself is apparently not now in question. Strangely enough, one young astronomy professor thrilled me as he told me of the moment of creation when our universe started its explosive expansion. Quote, "We were there. Every particle that goes into the atoms, the elements in your body, every bit of energy that you use now for thinking and moving everything, all of it was there. We were there. We're as near to creation," and the obvious implication of immortality, "as the pulse of the artery in our neck," unquote. Religion attributes form to these stages of this immortal existence. This definition of time of death becomes medically and economically important in this age of organ transplants. The doctors seek to protect themselves while also trying to preserve the needed tissues until the brainstem, that's that little Coke bottle shape section in the bottom of the brain covered over by all the convoluted stuff, and it controls the fundamentals like respiration and heart rate. Wait until it has stopped all activity. In order to do that, of course, they have to put the patient on a respirator and pacemaker, keep the lungs and the heart going, because otherwise the tissues that they want to harvest will become worthless. You wonder about organ transplants. There is an element of extending life here rather than just postponing death, which is what a lot of our energy goes into. Well, we must wait until this point is... Why must we wait until this point of complete electrical death is arrived at if all thinking and feeling is gone? Almost everybody gets into the act. The relatives, the hospitals, the coroner, the transport facilities, the government, the social workers, the ethicists, the clergy, and so forth, as well as the prospective recipient. Perhaps we should not do organ transplants. They're very expensive. Kidney transplants are, quote, cost-effective, unquote, only because they eliminate the government-subsidized kidney dialysis. If you don't do organ transplants, where do you draw the line? What about corneal transplants, where the previously blind are now able to see with a new cornea? What judgments can and should we make about this for ourselves, for our loved ones, and for our society? Is there a God's will factor involved? Death is usually not very pretty. We tend to deny its ugliness with mortician work and embalming and vaults and elaborate funeral ritual. Donation of organs should really present no religious problems, except in the belief of an absolutely literal point of death resurrection. A scientific understanding of the body's physiology reveals a constant turnover of the elements composing it, even the calcium in the bones. So we really have several bodies during our lifetime. Recreation should present no problem. If the Creator did it once, he can do it again, maybe even do a better job. Who knows? Most of us, of course, would rather have our 19-year-old bodies if given our druthers. The disposing of the dead by burial, one of six usual ways, and with cremation a leading present method, often has provided anthropologists with clues as to the people's concepts of life and death in the past. Though the only surviving tombs were usually of important individuals and did not necessarily or completely reflect the beliefs of the masses of ordinary people, most of whom had only a shroud, if that. From burial customs, we can infer many of the religious beliefs, for these dictated the way the feet or the head was pointed in the grave and whether the body was in fetal position or stretched out or on its side or on its back. The feet were commonly pointed in the direction the deceased was supposed to walk when resurrected. It's interesting that when you dig up a tomb, a grave in Egypt, you can tell whether it was before the Christian religion hit there or after, because the direction of the feet changes at that point. Preservation of the corpse or mummification or the bones or only the skull all reflected different aspects of religious belief. The ancient Egyptian practice assumes almost literal resurrection, Hence the need for the reserve body, including the organs, the lavish accoutrements, the food, and so forth. In some societies, the deceased man's favorite wife or wives, and his slave or slaves, and his soldiers were sacrificed and buried with him to be able to minister to his needs and comfort in the afterlife. The buried army of mounted warriors in the tomb of the Chinese emperor may have been a substitute for an actual army. For in sophisticated societies, as one author put it, inexpensive replicas of the deceased possessions are burned or buried with them instead of the real thing, which sensibly leaves the heirs in possession of the valuables. And the most rational method of disposal is cremation, which accounts for about 40% of the burials in the United States today. I was a little surprised to find that figure. It's also the most common method worldwide. In China, the Chinese, with their ancient ancestor worship, once finally used up their agricultural land for cemeteries and were forced to alter their beliefs in order to survive. In the crowded cemeteries in East Prussia, where I served as on a mission, the gravesite was for 40 years, renewable for another 40 if anybody cared. After that, the gravesite was opened for another burial. With the development of writing, much more information became available to us about past religious beliefs and concepts of death. The Egyptian Book of the Dead has a long list of specific instructions for the deceased to use to obtain a desired position in the afterlife. The Tibetan Book of the Dead had instructions to be read to the deceased by the priests, the length of the reading and the number of priests, of course, being proportional to the wealth of the deceased. The concept of the human essence or spirit or soul which left at death necessitated the concept of when it arrived in life. The papal ensoulment, quote-unquote, time doctrine, when the sperm enters the egg and a blueprint for a human being becomes possible, has created no end of troublesome ramification theories, and the papal infallibility claim makes dialogue or rational thinking entirely impossible. Pope John Paul II angrily declared that his dogma, unchangeable, beyond legitimate debate, and binding upon all those who would adhere to the truth of reason and natural law, unquote. He essentially reverted to the error has no rights doctrine of the Catholic Church, which supposedly repudiated in 1965, which states that only truth, that is the Catholic Church, has a right to exist. Some of our Mormon popes have adopted the Catholic ensoulment timing, but they're a bit short of claiming infallibility. Hopefully, LDS teachings and perceptions can and will change as our knowledge of and control over the processes of life and death increases. Perhaps everyone should be required to take courses in comparative vertebrate anatomy and in human embryology, along with chemistry, physics, astronomy, and so forth. Without knowledge, opinions are mere speculation and are generally worth little. As one psychiatrist put it, data-free conclusions is a priestly prerogative. There's a long list of things which we've been commanded by the Lord to study in Doctrine and Covenants 121. All of the life-death aspects fall under these broad categories. It will be interesting to see what evolves with regard to things like artificial insemination. When you get into perplexities like, what if the husband's sperm is deficient? I mean, you look at them when you do a sperm count, you know, and you got to have 90% of normals and the dead ones and the two-headed ones and so forth. Well, can't be more than about 10%. You got to have more than a few million or it just won't work. Who then is an eligible donor? What if a woman wants a child and she's unmarried? Then who's to be the donor? I'll give you another theoretical one. Suppose a young man and woman are engaged and he has a tumor of the testicle, cancer. It's removed and his semen from the other testicle is frozen. Suppose then they didn't catch the cancer in time and he dies. And she says, I want to bear his baby. And you're the bishop who has to answer the question, what is going to be your answer? This is not as theoretical as it may seem. What do you think about the giving of hormones to stimulate ovulation, which has produced, you know, half a dozen to a dozen eggs? It's also produced 4, 5, and 6 babies at a crack, or 5 in San Bernardino, an LDS woman who was having infertility problems and was given that medicine. But many times in infertility cases, they will give the woman this, and then they will retrieve half a dozen or a dozen eggs surgically, inseminate them in a petri dish, and then implant a number of them back into the womb of that woman, sometimes of another woman. I suppose most of you are familiar with this picture that came out. This is the twins in Holland. Somebody wasn't too careful about what pipette they used in that. And you have one brown baby and one white one, twins. Another brouhaha occurs in Los Angeles, or in the vicinity. Apparently an egg or eggs was given to an infertile woman, and she had twins. The problem was that she was not the mother and her husband was not the father of those eggs. And the biological father and mother, at least they claim they are Christian, and they were incensed that these twins were going to be raised Jewish. They were demanding a DNA analysis. I don't know how that one will come out yet. What about surrogate motherhood? Suppose you have a sister, a beloved sister who's barren. Would you bear a child for her? An egg can be taken from her, fertilized with her husband's semen, and you would go 9 months carrying the child? What about a mother doing that? Or what about if you were offered $10,000 or $20,000 to do it? That has happened, and of course, that caused a lot of trouble too. What is it permissible to do with the unused fertilized eggs? The egg is a huge cell. It's about 1/4 the size of a typewriter, period. You can even see it. When a sperm gets in, the cell shuts the door on the rest of the millions. But sometimes 2 or 3 get in at the same time, and the egg has only one of those half sets of chromosomes to share. So what happens? Actually, an estimated 75 to 80% of the fertilized eggs never produce a human being. In fact, they can produce a weird kind of cancer known as the teratoma that has all 3 primary germinal layers. So most of the fertilized eggs even are lost. The egg first divides, then divides again, and then again. At this 8-cell stage, one of the cells can be taken out without killing it, and check its DNA. Study it to see if it carries the genes for diseases like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease, hereditary breast cancer, and so forth. If it carries an undesirable gene, that egg can be abandoned for another. Suppose it's a girl and you already have 3. Do you abandon it and look for a boy? You have some more? You want brown eyes instead of blue? Eventually it would be possible to change the chromosomes and tailor-make the fetus to a certain extent. Even now we have a little girl alive who would have died if she had not had a gene inserted into her to remedy the lack which gave her a lethal hereditary disease. What about the fertilized legs that are left over, quote-unquote? If you subscribe to the Catholic ensoulment time, these are humans. Disposing of them is killing. Since they will die anyway, why not watch them and study them and see how far we can get to develop them to develop in an artificial environment? To learn more of how God did it should increase the stability of our faith, not lessen it. We're certainly a long ways from being able to create even the most primitive bacteria, so our competition should not threaten our Creator. We are commanded to study, and this is certainly not confined to reading religious tomes. Death often involves the taking of life by the individual involved, suicide, call it, or by others, homicide, by societies, execution, by nations, genocide, war. Suicide has long been soundly condemned by Jewish, Christian, and Muslim religions, with help from their religion-directed societies, and the estate of the deceased or the relatives are punished. To overtly shorten one's existence is somehow interfering with God's divine plan, quote-unquote, just as contraception is, or onanism, or homosexuality, which also thwart it. However, zealous fundamentalist religion can pervert these standard beliefs. The young Arab boy who commits suicide by blowing himself and his innocent Israeli victims to bits with explosives is reportedly promised immediate passage to heaven with 72 virgin wives, 70 passports to paradise for himself and his friends, and he will be an instant and famous hero. Note, religious belief is officially ruled out as a criteria for sanity-insanity in psychiatric assessment, but I privately feel that much religious, quote-unquote, belief is insane and much is nonsensical. I remember vividly the glass-enclosed tomb in the old Paris cemetery, which had been erected by the heartbroken young husband for his wife, who, grief-stricken from the loss of their three young daughters in 1 week by the plague, had committed suicide. She was condemned to eternal damnation by the Catholic Church. This harsh concept was modified in English law to exempt those who were of unsound mind, quote-unquote. However, someone who deliberately ended their life to escape physical or emotional torture by disease or human inflicted was vicariously punished somehow. Why the idea aroused such tremendous anxiety and produced such a reaction escapes me, but then my belief is in a less draconian deity. Harakiri was a favor sometimes granted by the Japanese emperor to a samurai warrior condemned to death. He could save face and keep his honor intact by suicide instead of being beheaded like a common criminal. Our Supreme Court has ducked the issue of state law forbidding suicide assist, no matter how compassionate the intent. People intentionally or inadvertently shorten their life all the time by bad lifestyles. They are passively punished in the sense of opportunities missed, or worse. If an animal is suffering, we humanely end its life, but we deny this compassion officially to our fellow humans. Dr. Kevorkian is raising havoc in the legal, ethical, religious circles by his assisting the dying to go with dignity and with some control over their destiny. He claims that we have the right to say enough. Question, how far does our agency, our freedom to make choices, extend? When we tie down a helpless patient and feed them with a nasogastric tube and maintain breathing with a respirator and the heart with a pacemaker, we've turned compassionate nursing into the ultimate tyranny. We have stripped that person of every vestige of control over their life, of agency, of everything which makes them human. Resources and time are expended because the doctor or the relatives or perhaps the patient are unwilling to let go. The million-dollar Siamese twin girl fiasco occurred because the junkie father enjoyed the compassion money, he bought a pickup with it, and the publicity, and the Catholic doctors and hospital could not say no to his wishes. One girl was, of course, sacrificed at surgery, the other died later. Question, why did society not intervene and let them die, quote, naturally, unquote? Since, as one doctor put it, life is a terminal illness, why shouldn't we be willing to let go? In the religious nursing homes, where there was a firm belief in the hereafter, many of my patients were expectantly waiting for death as a friend, as a release to go on, since they could no longer be overtly useful in this life. The patient riddled with metastatic cancer is different, as is the mind-depleted patient with the drooping open mouth and the vacant eyes who doesn't know where he is or who he is or even that he is. Why use things to prolong this caricature of life? It goes against the grain of what I feel deeply is right. In fact, if I had the say-so, I don't think I would allow any or almost any convalescent hospital patients to be admitted to the intensive care unit. If they could not be cared for in the normal ward unit in the hospital, then I think the time had come. I don't see using the horribly expensive intensive care facilities, because most of the time all you've done is prolong death. You haven't extended life. Surely quality of life should be considered more important. Note, it took one of my patients, a man with a lung cancer, a month to choke to death as the tumor mass slowly cut off his air. This is when I was an intern. If so much morphine was needed to relieve a patient's pain that it depressed their respiration, who should care? The one prominent oncologist a few years ago was arrested for murder in Los Angeles due to an uptight whistleblowing nurse and a publicity-hungry district attorney. When he gave a little more than what the book said, the woman who was drowning in her own fluids, dying, gave her a little more than what the book said, amount of morphine that he should. Who has the right, quote-unquote, who has the obligation, quote-unquote, to pull the plug, to give the little extra morphine? One famous early Idaho doctor, you can read about him in a book called The Best Damn Doctor in the West, with his terminal heart attack, ordered the nurse out of the room and said, "Don't you come back for 2 hours." He did. Yes. When the young Juanita Brooks, keeping watch over the aged and dying patriarch, roused everyone because he was saying, "Blood, blood, blood," she was admonished, "Let him die. The poor man has been trying to die for a week." I heard that from Juanita Brooks' own lips. The discussion of death leads to the disposal problem. Why have the Latter-day Saints traditionally avoided cremation? Is it too radical a separation from both soul and body for the psyche to bear? Jewish burial customs recommend burial very soon after death, and in the plainest of wooden coffins. They are, incidentally, available for less than $500 plus shipping. The Jewish religion, of course, has required mourning aid a year, where you have to get in a group of people and say a given prayer. This is obligatory for men, recommended, I think, for women. The family and the friends at a Jewish funeral throw the first shovelfuls of earth on the coffin. The sound of the clods hitting the box drives home the reality of death through the sense of hearing. All the mourners at some funerals actively participate in burying their dead by throwing on handfuls of earth. We leave and do not even watch. The reality of death, of course, is in our society we're deprived of that reality, as few people now live on the farms where death and live birth are part of a survival cycle, or were. I don't know how many of you have chopped off chickens' heads. I've done it by the dozens. Shot the swine that you were going to butcher, or the steer. Was it emotionally sounder when the Relief Society sisters washed and dressed the body while the priesthood brethren made the coffin and dug the grave? Here is a brochure from the Neptune Society. It shows 75 things that you have to take care of when somebody dies. We have made it extremely complicated and expensive. There is a recent directive to the effect that since the funeral is held in a church building, the service should resemble a sacrament meeting with sermons by those in authority and so forth. I forgot where I bumped into that. Talks by family and friends are to be discouraged since they might relate memorable or humorous anecdotes about the deceased. If the pious blue noses succeed in making funerals into another sacrament meeting, which is a strange attitude toward death and also toward the worth of the deceased individual, I want my funeral in a concert hall with full orchestra and speeches by friends and family only, and that can be the bishop if he's still my friend. At a recent funeral of an elderly beloved aunt, there was as much love and pleasant recollection as there was mourning and grief. She'd lived a rich and useful life. There's a phrase from the Old Testament that I like. He's an old man satisfied with life. Like most LDS funerals, have had this positive note, in contrast to some Protestant funerals I've attended, and one which I had to conduct where I had to literally pry the grieving father off the coffin of a son. The grief at all funerals is greater when the deceased is a young child or youth. Then the question why often has no answer. We can only gain consolation from songs such as Sometime We'll Understand. The number of infant deaths has plummeted, so there are no longer as many small coffins as large ones on display in the funeral homes. As it were, that was what it was like when I was a youth. I know, I delivered them up to the funeral home. And we no longer have to produce 10 children to raise one to adulthood. I thank God for giving me the privilege of living when the retching loss of a beloved child is less frequent. I'm old enough to have seen what happened to the parents' lives when diphtheria took their two beautiful children within 1 week. I'm still haunted by the father's grief at the death of his lovely daughter, my companion through 12 years of school, who died of strep throat 2 weeks before high school graduation. Note, both of those can now be prevented. I remember a different grief when my grandfather died. Grandmother grieved not that he was gone, but that he had had to suffer so in the last week. Question, what does it cost in pain and grief and money for Americans to die? $50,000 to $60,000 for the last 6 months of life? Hospital bills and funerals? $5,000 to $10,000 for the funeral? How much can or should we afford, ethically afford? As a family or as a society even? When I started to practice of medicine, the idea that people should die in the hospital, not at home, had not yet taken root. And without insurance, that helpful but nefarious disorder of rationality, you know, someone else is paying for it, the patient often entered into the decision-making, choosing to die at home rather than wreck the family finances. Now the patients are transferred to the convalescent hospital to keep them from wrecking the acute hospital's finances. I feel that patients should have the right to die at home if possible, surrounded by familiar and revered objects and by their loved ones and caretakers. Admittedly, it requires the right situation with the right doctor and nurse, plus the right attitude of those upon whom the burden of care will fall. I have participated in many deaths at home since I made house calls. First, I judged the feasibility, then provided instruction, care, and moral support, teaching the caregivers, and that's a word I don't like, incidentally, that's a the procedures of nursing care. One woman whose husband had advanced Alzheimer's, so he had to be tube-fed, said, "We stay here till one of us dies." She did a beautiful job of nursing him until he mercifully died of a heart attack a couple of years later. Her bed was alongside his hospital bed, and she was on 24-hour-a-day duty. He slept well, so she was able to get adequate rest herself. If you can't do that, then it's a two-people job or send it to the convalescent hospital. I stayed on 24-hour-a-day call by giving her my home phone number, and I'd go by about once a month. Another woman with terminal liver cancer had 6 months of enjoyable life at home once her nurse granddaughter, her daughter, and I got her nausea and pain under control. Brief weekly house call visits to reassure them, actually to praise them, for you can't buy this quality of care, was my main role. Question, should we Latter-day Saints work to encourage more of this, or am I outdated? How much pain and suffering, both physical and emotional, in life should we expect or tolerate or allow in others? Some theologians have argued that it was part of life and therefore normal, God's will. One claimed that since Jesus was tortured to death on the cross, we should all suffer that same kind of pain to be like him. Note, crucifixion death was so slow and agonizing that soldiers sometimes broke the legs or thrust in a spear to hasten it. Doctors are frequently fortunately getting over their two-decade neurosis about narcotics and are now giving adequate doses of morphine and so forth for the control of pain. often letting the patient control their own morphine drip. Less is needed to keep the pain away than to repeatedly get rid of it. And constant pain is psychologically devastating. Why do you think they use torture? Extra morphine may shorten the postponing of death, which we call prolonging life, but is this not a blessing? Why should people not face death pain-free? And that means not only physical pain, but emotional pain. Anxiety and depression are pain. They're forms of emotional pain, very serious forms. How many people commit suicide every year from physical pain, cancer? Oh, a few. How many people commit suicide every year from depression, from emotional pain? 10, 20,000? What is that figure? You can tell which one is the more serious and which one is the tougher for doctors to treat. Fortunately, our Latter-day Saint religion comes helpfully in relieving some of this emotional pain. How can we best apply our concepts of life and death as revealed to us by the Prophet Joseph Smith and by the doctors and scientists who study such things? Do we or should we permit people to have control over their own death? What kind of control? How much control? And what about life? Should we not make full use of birth control measures to prevent unwanted children and to preserve our species? Will each religion or ethnic group still seek to outbreed the other one to achieve dominance? Overpopulation can again bring the pale horse of the apocalypse, for death from war and famine and pestilence are the fruits of overcrowding and inadequate food supply. Interestingly, half the people who've ever lived on this earth are alive today. So there will be lots of death within the next 70 years, even without the aid of this fourth horseman. The final question is this: on what do we base, what do we use in the way of our religious mythology, teachings, our background, our knowledge, our personal and prophetic revelations, to formulate ideas about life and death from which we can deduce rational actions? Common sense, logic, and reason should apply, as well as revelation. Fortunately, our church was brought into being because of the necessity of continual revelation, a revolt against the closed book, static attitude of the Christian religions. And the revelation will be, or should be, constantly changing, as our knowledge and understanding make us capable of receiving more revelation. Revelation is not just another perfect brick that we add to the perfect pile that we already have. Throughout history, theologians and philosophers have constructed huge upside-down pyramids of thought and action, balancing precariously on their tips on some tiny point of their particular interpretation of Scripture. The Garden of Eden story, which I once gave a paper on, has produced everything from self-flagellating celibate hermit to the rejoicing Gnostic claiming that marriage and sex was following God's example. How trustworthy is our intellect, our reasoning, and our experiential contacts with deity? How trustworthy are we in interpreting them, since we've all been biased all our lives by the repetition of the Bible tales? Though the prophet Joseph Smith probably knew the King James Bible by heart, he still did not hesitate to rewrite or modify it. What would his instructions be today, I wonder? Remember that prophets are and have been throughout recorded religious history young rebels, dissenters, rejecting the status quo of religious belief and social practice. And, of course, there have also been women prophets, according to the account of King Josiah sending prophetess Hull after authentication. How can we craft new understanding and new attitudes about death and life in the light of modern discoveries and social practices without losing the precious heritage inherent in our religion? I can only give you questions, not answers. But this journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first simple step of asking the right questions, of stepping, hopefully, in the right direction. God does not tell you what questions to ask. I pray with you.